really my great pleasure to be introducing Velu Marik as our Monday seminar speaker today. He's a professor at the University of Utah, and he has a very long and interesting training history. And I wanted to give everyone a little bit of an overview. And I have to admit that since I've only known Velu in the current C. elegans stage of his career, I had to do a little detective work and go to our mutual friend and colleague, Roger Nickel, to get the scoop on how and why Velu took the path he did. And this is how the story goes. Velu did his undergraduate work at Brown University. After that, he then went to UCSF as a medical student. He was not a typical medical student in as much as he was so intrigued and fascinated by basic science. He wanted to do an MD-PhD. However, in what was described as an unforgivable mistake, the MSTP committee did not accept him. He was undeterred. He took a rather atypical path and ended up doing a joint program with Berkeley. So he got his PhD from Berkeley and his MD from UCSF. He did his thesis work in Juan Kornbrot's laboratory studying cone photoreceptors. And he was also closely mentored during this time by Jim Hudspeth, and the two of them hit it off extremely well. And it was during this time that he really honed his basic biophysics skills. And this was a productive time, but when he got his PhD, he wanted to go and do something different. This is a common theme with Velu, wanting to take his skills and go in a new direction. He decided to do postdoctoral work with David Julius, who was just coming to UCSF at the time. And the idea was that he would bring his rock-solid biophysics and to Julius's laboratory. And in return, Julius would train him in molecular biology. This turned out, once again, to be extremely productive and resulted in a science paper describing the cloning and identification of the 5-HT3 serotonin receptor. This was actually Julius's first paper at UCSF, and obviously Velu picked up some molecular skills along the way. He then wanted to go in yet a new direction and use his biophysics and now his molecular training. And after discussions with Corey Bargman, they decided that the ideal path would be to use C. elegans as a model organism, the idea being that the forward genetics, the unbiased approach of forward genetics, allows you to identify new molecules and unravel mechanisms that you wouldn't find using a different approach. So in Corey's lab, once again, he was very successful, very high-profile paper identifying what he calls GLUR1, glutamate receptor in the worm. And he's continued in his independent career to make very important contributions studying glutamatergic synapses. This is a topic close to my heart, but he's also validated his approach in that he's been able to identify proteins and mechanisms that wouldn't have been found otherwise. So using the worm, he's able to look at not only synaptic transmission, but also circuits and behavior. He's won many awards. I'm not going to list them. He's also been a very good citizen. He serves on study section. And before I turn it over, I should say on a personal note, when I think about Velu, I don't think about this impeccable pedigree, which he does have, or the long list of papers which are really invariably published in very high-impact journals. What I think about is his enthusiasm, and it's really infectious. Velu, you can't go away from a conversation with Velu without being excited about science, not just his science, but also reinvigorated about your own work. And I think that's what makes Velu truly extraordinary.
Wow. Thank you very much, Catherine. Hopefully this will work now. Well, again, thank you, Catherine. I'm really delighted to be here. When I was last here, there was just the hints of a shell of a building for the new neuroscience building, and now it's this beautiful new research building with lots of great science in it, and which I've learned some about this morning, and I'm continuing to meet with people this afternoon, which I'm very much looking forward to. You know, Catherine's introduction brought back a lot of memories about my circuitous training path. And if it seems fragmented, I guess in some ways it was fragmented, but it seems like all holistic at this point. One of the nice things about doing an MD-PhD program, even a kind of a non-traditional MD-PhD program like I did, is that when you finish your PhD, typically PhD students know exactly what lab they want to go to next because they're in the field, they know everyone in the field, and they're off to do, you know, the most logical postdoc, which is someone that they've met at a conference or whatever. And having a two-year break to finish your clinical rotations in med school gives you a tremendous, you know, opportunity to sit back and look at the bigger picture. And that was having that time to think about where I wanted to go next, and thinking molecular biology training was really essential, was a big part of my research training. Anyway, today I'm going to talk to you about our approach to understanding how the brain works. Everyone in this audience is interested in some degree to unlocking the secrets of the brain. And I'm going to tell you kind of three intermingled stories today on our approach to figure out how the brain works. First, our approach, as Catherine mentioned, is based on perturbation analysis. Okay? So I'm going to convince you that perturbation analysis and forward genetics is the way to go, or a way to go. Second, I'm going to try and convince you that the study of simpler nervous systems can perhaps yield fundamental truths that apply to all nervous systems. And third, I'm going to give you specific factoids that we've learned, and the specific take-home message that I want everyone to leave with is that at least one class of ionotropic glutamate receptors, the class called the AMPA receptors, is probably best thought of as a pretty complex signaling complex. And so I'm going to provide genetic evidence to kind of support that statement. So there are many different strategies to study brain function. I guess you could call this the top-down approach. And these kind of approaches have been extremely fruitful: perturbation analysis, ablation analysis, removing chunks of brain and trying to figure out what's going on has given us fundamental insights into how the brain works. There's also a bottom-up approach, and that's the approach I'm going to try and push, and that's studying the element of communication between the billions of neurons in our brains, and these synapses are shown here in green in a cultured hippocampal neuron. And the synapses number in the thousands per neuron and are the sites of cell-to-cell communication, as you're all aware. And a canonical synapse has three elements: the presynaptic component that contains vesicles, that contain neurotransmitter, which upon electrical activity, the neurotransmitter is released into the synaptic cleft and then can diffuse over and bind to different receptors on the postsynaptic membrane, thus reinitiating an electrical activity. So you have electrical, chemical, and back to electrical again. And most drugs that work work on brain activity typically work at the synapse because this is a drug-accessible space. And how these synapses work is of primary importance to most neuroscientists because the synapse is really what most people consider where the rubber meets the road. This is where most information processing takes place, or at least a good deal of information processing. Now, recent proteomic studies have completely muddied the waters. So instead of a nice cartoon of having a few postsynaptic receptors at the postsynaptic density, proteomic studies suggest that there is maybe 1,200 different proteins that are all selectively expressed or preferentially expressed at the postsynaptic density. So this now turns into a huge problem of how do you, you know, whatever postsynaptic density protein you study is the most important one to you, and you're going to try and knock it out, and you will find a phenotype eventually. But how do we make sense of the entire collection of proteins, and how do you rank their importance in some way? Synapses are incredibly well conserved across evolution. Brains aren't. So our brains, or mammalian brains, have billions of neurons, insects tens of thousands, and nematodes only a few hundred, 302 to be exact. So complexity in number is not conserved. But it turns out that most of those molecules that I told you were at the postsynaptic density and at the presynaptic active zone seem to be conserved. So you can find the essential set of proteins in nematodes, insects, and mammals. And to a first approximation, their function is rather well conserved. So if you want to try and study synaptic biology, and if you want to do perturbation, It may be, in perturbation analysis, it may be fruitful to study a simpler organism with the idea that what you're going to learn is a simple organism is going to be conserved. So this view of thinking is that hundreds of millions of years ago, what evolved were basic synapses, and these synapses are specialized for information processing. So you can think of these as processing modules that are going to have some complement of specific protein. The processing modules are probably conserved, but the complexity of the system is not conserved. One of the major molecules at the postsynaptic density in all nervous systems that mediates excitatory neurotransmission is the family of ionotropic glutamate-gated ion channels. Okay, so the primary neurotransmitter in our brains and essentially all brains is glutamate, and it binds to a diverse set of receptors. Amongst these are the ionotropic glutamate receptors, and they all work kind of something like this. This would be a top-down view of a tetrameric arrangement of four subunits, and in a closed state, there's no current, and glutamate binding is going to cause this receptor complex to open, and you can measure that opening by looking at an inward current. And then this current, even in the continued presence of glutamate, desensitizes, and the receptor is closed again. And so this is just a sideways view showing that binding here to these S1, S2 regions causes a conformational change that in some unknown way causes poor opening and allows current to flow through. And ionotropic glutamate receptors were first classified on the basis of pharmacological specificity, so those preferentially activated by AMPA, kainate, or NMDA receptors. And it turns out molecular studies have confirmed these classifications. So it looks like, to first approximation, there's the NMDA class, and then AMPA and kainate subclasses. Now, I just want to mention this thing about desensitization again, which maybe 15, 20 years ago, people thought was an annoying property that made it harder to study receptors. But more and more, it's been recognized that desensitization is probably a very essential feature of all synapses. It allows changes in the bandwidth of neurotransmission. It changes the way information is processed depending on the speed of desensitization and the recovery from desensitization. So desensitization itself is also evolutionarily conserved. If you look in any nervous system at any synapse where there's glutamatergic neurotransmission, you'll see that there is desensitization. And those desensitization patterns are pretty well conserved across evolution. It's pretty amazing. In addition to just the information processing by a subset of ionotropic glutamate receptors, the regulation of these receptors is also thought to contribute to synaptic plasticity, and the current model of how that all works is that potentiation of a synapse leads to insertion of more AMPA receptors, which then diffuse and localize to the postsynaptic membrane, and that you can also depotentiate, and the way you depotentiate is remove receptors, AMPA receptors, from the postsynaptic density. And there's intense interest into the molecular mechanisms that control this receptor trafficking. Again, since I'm at the NIH, I should remind you all that this has tremendous relevance to neurological disorders. Glutamate receptors and their dysfunction has been implicated in excitotoxicity, which is a model for stroke and ischemic damage, epilepsy, neurodegenerative disorders, and psychiatric disorders. And the pharmacological industries put a tremendous amount of effort into looking for drugs that target glutamate receptors, and so there are many glutamate receptors, are directed against NMDA receptors and some against AMPA receptors that are being now tried for anti-epileptic properties, neurodegenerative disorders, et cetera. I would say that, in general, these drugs have not been a resounding success. Their side effects limit their efficacy. And so I'll come back to this at the end of the talk as to why genetic studies may provide us with more drug targets that perhaps will allow more specific drugs to be designed that could have clinical efficacy. So, how do you discover these new drug targets? Well, our approach is to try and understand how to build a glutamatergic synapse. And we want to take a very unbiased approach. We want to understand, in the long term, how do you build one of these things going from soup to nuts, okay? And if you think about it just in terms of the glutamate receptors alone, it's kind of a daunting challenge. So we know almost nothing about the genes that are required for transcription of glutamate receptors, their trafficking, They're targeting, so they go here and not here, for example. The genes required for their insertion, function, and even regulating neurotransmitter release. So to get a complete picture, we need kind of all of these steps. This would be how you could build a glutamatergic neurotransmitter just from the point of view of how to get the receptors in the right place and that they function properly. So we want to use genetics. And we think genetics is going to help us because it gets rid of many biases. We don't necessarily have to have an entry point by yeast 2 hybrid or biochemical techniques. Those are all very fine and good. But then you're tied to that one link to try and bring down all the associated proteins. That's been a beautiful, beautiful approach. The problem is it's brought down about 1,200 proteins. And so now, how do you deal with all that complexity? So our idea is that we can use organismal behavior as a readout for those gene products that are most important for glutamatergic neurotransmission. So if we have a behavior that we can tightly link to a neural circuit, then we can use molecular genetics to perturb the entire genome and use the behavior as a readout for those perturbations that are really meaningful for that circuit and for that behavior. Okay? So the behavior now is our tool to validate which ones are we going to study first. And the system that we've chosen to study is, the nervous system we've chosen to study is that of C. elegans, a simple soil nematode. And it has many advantages for the kind of studies that I'm proposing. One is that we know where all the 302 neurons and muscles are located. It's extremely easy to make transgenic worms. So this is the worm. It's about 1 millimeter long. This is a self-fertilizing hermaphrodite. Here is its head, and here is its tail. And you can see here in the transgenic worm where there's a promoter-driving GFP and just a small subset of interneurons, you can see that these interneurons send their processes down, making synapses onto other neurons. There's also a small one neuron here in the tail. And we can make transgenic worms that express glutamate receptors that are tagged with GFP. And when we do that, we see now that there are these little puncta here. And for a variety of evidence points to these puncta are individual synapses. So in a live moving worm, you can actually visualize the neurons as well as the synapses. Why is the genetics so great here? Worms are self-fertilizing. So what do you need a nervous system for in the first place? One of the things you need a nervous system for is sex. You have to find a partner to have sex with. If you don't, you're not going to propagate. But a worm can have sex even though it's completely paralyzed because it makes its own sperm and eggs, and so it can propagate. So if you have a mutation that's really deleterious, you can still propagate it and study it. The second thing you need a nervous system for is to eat. You have to find food and resources or you starve. And here, there's another advantage for the worm. The worm has kind of a peristaltic pump so that, like our heart, can work pretty well even though there's no nervous system input. So even with no nervous system, the worm can feed itself. It lies in a puddle of food on a petri dish and in a bacterial pool, and it will absorb enough nutrients that way. So it's great. We can have severe genetic perturbations and still study them and keep the strain of worm going. The other reason this is a very good system is I show here the synapses. The worm has altogether 302 neurons, about 7,000 synapses. So it has the synaptic complexity of about one hippocampal pyramidal cell, right? But it can do a lot with that small number of neurons and synapses. So today, I'll tell you that genetic analysis has shown us that GLUR1, which is an AMPA type receptor, does not work like a standalone molecule. So to remind you, until very recently, most people have thought of ionotropic glutamate receptors as standalone molecules. You clone the receptor, whether it's GluR1 or GluR2 or GluR3, you throw them into some expression system, and they form receptors. And those receptors work just fine. And so it's thought that these have always been standalone molecules. I'll make the argument that you can't even think of these receptors as standalone molecules anymore. They need at least two other proteins. One is a stargazing-type molecule, and the second one is SOL1. A novel transmembrane protein that we discovered in our genetic screens. So let me lead you through how we did this and why we make this conclusion. So first, a little review. There's 302 neurons, and a subset of these neurons are interneurons, And these interneurons all express glutamate receptors. So GLUR1 and GLUR2 are AMPA-type receptors. NMR1 is an NMDA receptor. There is a neuron. This is a polymodal sensory neuron, so it's one pair of neurons, that responds to a number of noxious stimuli, like tactile stimuli or osmotic stimuli, and signals to these inner neurons, and the net result is the worm stops going forward, backs away, and goes in another direction. So this circuit is very important for, among other things, avoidance responses. If you knock out E4, which is the vesicular glutamate uptake protein, then you abolish this behavior. And if you knock out various glutamate receptors, including GLUR1, then you also mess up this behavior dramatically. So the kind of behaviors that we study are putting something in their path, like a drop of hyperosmotic fructose or a hair. And as the worm goes forward, it recoils from that. It's sensed by ASH, by releasing glutamate, which talks to these inner neurons, which then controls eventual movement. So we now have a quantifiable behavior. That quantifiable behavior is linked to a small neural circuit. In this small neural circuit, we know at least some of the molecules that are there and the effect of deleting these molecules. So we have knockouts of all the glutamate receptors in the worm. I'm going to be talking mostly about GLUR1 and its knockout. In a GLUR1 knockout, osmotic avoidance and tactile avoidance are severely disrupted. So now we can go back and ask the original question, how do you build a glutamatergic synapse? So I told you, if I knock out this glutamate receptor, I no longer have a quantifiable avoidance response. And so from a geneticist point of view, I should be able to randomly mutagenize the genome. And if I knock out any step in this process, I should be able to phenocopy that avoidance defect, right? So in other words, if the receptor is made, targeted, but never gets inserted, it's as though it's a null, right? There should be no AMPA current, and so the avoidance response should be messed up. So this is a very straightforward genetic screen. You can get graduate students to mutagenize randomly the genome and then look for worms that no longer respond to tactile response or osmotic response. And this talk always works extremely well when I have prospective graduate students. But after a couple of months of tapping worms and having them go into hair and see when they go back, they're ready to kill me, right? Because it's just such a boring, boring screen. And so we've had to turn to a different strategy, and that different strategy is to look in a sensitized genetic background. That is, we're going to make now a transgenic worm that expresses a gain-of-function mutant, and that gain-of-function mutant is going to make our job much, much easier. And I'll show you what I mean by that. So I told you one of the strengths of our system is that we can go from behavior to neural circuit to receptor. And the idea is that we need a very sensitive system so that if we perturb a receptor, for example, we can see that there is a defect. And I showed you that if I perturb a glutamate receptor, if I knock it out, I don't have normal avoidance response anymore. But we can do even better than that. Here is another behavior that depends on AMPA receptors, and that's the duration of forward movement. The worms typically spend most of their time exploring their environment going forward. And this is a response to glutamate from one of these inner neurons, and you see that there's a big glutamate-gated current that then desensitizes in the continued presence of glutamate. So I'll get back to the electrophysiology in a bit. But what I want to show you now is there's a forward time, and this is the current that we see when we spritz on glutamate from one of these inner neurons. Now, if we make a transgenic worm that expresses a variant of a glutamate receptor, so this one is a QY mutation. This is the famous LY mutation first described by Rosenmund and Sternbach. To make it simple for you, if you put this mutation into a glutamate receptor, it no longer desensitizes very well. You can see that this desensitization looks very different than this desensitization. And in fact, you can map that desensitization to behavior. The behavior is dramatically different now in terms of its forward time. Again, showing that desensitization properties are very strongly conserved. They have important consequences for the behavior of an organism. Finally, we can put in another mutation that changes both desensitization and, in some poorly understood ways, the conductance of the receptor itself. So this is a smaller conductance, it's slower desensitization, and may have also a bit of a leak component. And here there's a huge difference in the forward time. So let me show you what that means in terms of a real worm. So this is a wild-type worm. And you can see that most of its time is spent going forwards. And so for 20 or 30 seconds, it'll go forward. The movie was interrupted there, so you didn't see the full duration of its forward movement. And then it spontaneously stops. When it stops, it usually reorients itself and goes off in some other direction. So now we've made a transgenic worm that expresses that lurching mutation I just showed you in the previous slide. And you can see that these worms are very, very different. So they go forward, they go back. They go forward, they go back. They move normally, but they never go anywhere. These are our obsessive compulsive worms, right? They're off to the grocery store. Oh, I left the gas on. Oh. And they just go back and forth, back and forth. This is just from changing the desensitization of an AMPA type receptor and just putting it back to replace the wild type copy. And of course, this is a geneticist's dream because we can exploit this change in behavior in a genetic screen. And what we do is we put, for example, wild type worms here on one side of the plate, and I put food on the other side of the plate, and then I just wait. And with about an hour, most of the worms are at the food. By 2 hours, essentially all the worms are at the food. Okay? So they sense the food, they spend most of their time going forward to get to the food, and they get there just fine. Now, the transgenic strain that I showed you, this is what I call the lurcher strain that has that point mutation in the AMPA receptor. In fact, they shuffle their way over there, but they're going back and forth the whole time, and so it takes them almost 2 hours, and they still get nowhere. And finally, after 2 hours, they slowly start arriving at the food. So the idea now is we should be able to exploit this in a genetic screen. In other words, if I knock out this gain-of-function receptor, I shouldn't have this gain-of-function behavior anymore, and the worm should get to the food just fine. So that's the essential idea. You start with this transgenic strain, you randomly mutagenize, and you look for those rare worms in this big pile of worms that makes it to the food within, let's say, an hour. And you pick that off, and then you see what's wrong with it. And so when we've done that, we found suppressors. And so here's a rather strong suppressor. You can see that it's much, much better off in terms of reaching the food than the starting strain, although it's not quite as good as the wild-type strain. And using straightforward techniques of molecular genetics, we can clone, we can identify the gene that was mutated. In this case, we identify the gene encoding a protein called SOL1. And SOL1 means suppressor of lurcher. So what's SOL1? SOL1 is an unexpected protein, perhaps a novel protein. It has four repeats of about 110 amino acid protein-protein interaction motif called the CUB domain. So this is predicted to be extracellular. Then there's a transmembrane domain, and then only about 2 or 3 amino acids that are predicted to be intracellular. So nothing like anything that was seen before at the postsynaptic density on the cytoplasmic side. This is an extracellular transmembrane protein. And our screens identify that this must be rather important because we have had multiple hits. So we have at least 3 different alleles. They're all nulls. 2 of them are early stops, and 1 of them is a missense mutation. So whatever it is, it keeps coming up in genetic screens. Now, it could be that SOL1 is a suppressor because it somehow interacts specifically with this weird gain of function channel that we put into the worm. And that would be interesting in its own right. But what you really want to see is if you cross out that transgenic background and you have only one mutation, the mutation in SOL1 itself, does it look like a glutamate receptor mutation? So here's another behavior that we look at, which is avoidance of a hair in one's path. So this is a sensory avoidance response. And wild-type worms are very good at avoiding this hair. But GLUR1 mutants that don't have glutamatergic neurotransmission mediated by AMPA receptors is very defective. And surprisingly, so is SOL1. So SOL1 phenocopies GLUR1. And we can show that this is a bona fide suppression of the response. That this mutation is really due to the SOL1 gene by putting in a wild-type copy of SOL1 in a genomic rescue experiment and showing that it rescues. So what's SOL1 doing? How is it creating a synapse that looks like there's no AMPA receptor-mediated neurotransmission? And again, it could be working at any one of these steps. And I'm going to just cut to the chase and say that, in fact, we've ruled out most of these early steps. So in a SOL1 mutant, if you look at the glutamate receptors, you find that they're in the exact right place where they should be, and they're at the cell surface. Okay? So the receptors are right there, just as in wild type. But it looks like they're not working. And this is where genetics typically kind of reaches a dead end, especially in C. elegans, because you can't open the black box any further. You have this small worm with a few neurons in it, and there's no electrical access to these things. And so a cynic might say, yeah, you phenocopy the loss of glutamate receptor, and that's just because, you know, that cell is sick. It's just a sick cell. It has nothing to do with receptor function. So we have to measure receptor function. And so to do that, we've taken advantage of the fact that you can make transgenic worms that express GFP in just a small subset of neurons. So you can see here 1, 2, 3, 4 neurons. It's these 1, 2, 3, 4 neurons. 1, 2, 3, 4 neurons. And then we take the worm, which is about 1 millimeter long, and we use glue and glue it down on a slide. And then using a fine microelectrode, we pierce the cuticle. So you can think of the worm as kind of like a submarine with a hard, crusty outer shell and soft neurons underneath. And we take the shell, the cuticle shell, and just peel it back. And that's shown here. So that's the cuticle peeled back now and glued down. And now we can expose the neurons. There they are, 1, 2, 3, 4. And since they're always in the same place, we can always go to the exact same neuron. This is a tremendous advantage. And we can use patch pipette techniques to record whole cell currents, let's say, from the neuron AVA, which we know by genetics is very important for this backward movement, and it expresses glutamate receptors. And so when we do that, we see, much to our delight, really big, nice glutamate-gated currents. So this is 1 millimolar glutamate puffed on with a Picot spritzer, and I'm holding it two different potentials, plus 40 or minus 60 millivolts. And you can see these really beautiful, rapidly activating currents that then desensitize in the continued presence of glutamate. And for the aficionados in the audience, this outward current here is blocked by intracellular polyamines. Anyway, so big currents. If you just looked at these currents, you wouldn't know if they were from a hippocampal neuron or from a worm neuron. Neurons themselves are kind of tricky to work with in the worm because they're small. They're only about 2 or 3 microns in diameter. But they have nice big currents. So what happens in the SOL1 mutant? Well, you can see that this fast current is gone. So at minus 60 millivolts, there's very little current. At plus 40, you see an outward current that decays slowly with time. And if you compare that to a GLUR1 mutant, you see the amazing thing that the currents themselves phenocopy. So SOL1 phenocopies a GLUR1 mutant in terms of behavior. And if it turns to the electrophysiological signature, SOL1 also phenocopies GLUR1. So if you didn't know better, you'd say SOL1 is just an essential subunit, right? This could be another glutamate receptor subunit. What's particularly pleasing about this result is that it shows specificity. The current that's remaining here is mediated by the NMDA receptors. So this is an NMDA-dependent current, and you can see if you knock out the glutamate receptor, the NMDA component is there, as it is in the SOL1 mutant. So whatever SOL1's doing, it's not messing up cell health in general. It's not messing up all glutamate-gated currents. It's messing up glutamate-gated currents mediated by the GLUR1 AMPA receptor. And again, we can rescue this by introducing the SOL1 genomic copy, genomic rescue. So what's SOL1 doing? It could be involved in gating, or it could be involved in desensitization, or some aspect of receptor function. We don't think that it has much to do with ligand binding. There's been tons of crystallographic work by Mark Mayer and Eric Duo and others showing that, in fact, this region of the receptor is sufficient to explain glutamate binding. So we don't think SOL1 has a primary role there, but it may have some role in the function of the receptor itself. And so how best to study that? Now, I'm kind of praising C. elegans as a great system where you can do genetics and electrophysiology, but the electrophysiology is tough. You got to do dissection. You got to get to the neuron. If you mess up the seal, you got to do a whole new dissection. You can't drink much coffee. It's not an easy life. So the time-honored approach to study receptors is to study them in heterologous cells. And so we tried doing that. We cloned all the components, GLUR1, GLUR2, SOL1, and we expressed them in Xenopus oocyte, a favorite of many of this room, I'm sure. And this was a long, long, painful, depressing episode in my life. Because each time we found something by genetics, like GLUR1, we thought, great, I'm going to express it in glutamate, in heterologous cells, and we should see now a nice glutamate-gated current. And in fact, I remember when I proposed this in my very first NIH grant, and a reviewer had written back, how do you know that expressing a glutamate receptor in Xenopus is actually going to work and you can study anything? And I remember thinking, oh my God, you know, boy, they're giving me a hard time. I mean, everything works when you express it in Xenopus oocytes, you know? And I just finished a postdoc with Julius where I'd been expressing, you know, the 5-HT3 receptor and expression cloning. And I just thought this was a really harsh criticism. I talked my way out of it, luckily. But, of course, the reviewer was right. It didn't work. And then we got, by genetics, GLUR2, and it also didn't work. We put GLUR1 and GLUR2 together, thinking these are the two essential subunits. And then we got SOL1. I just showed you SOL1 was essential. And then we put all three into Xenopus oocytes, and it still didn't work. And at this point, we were depressed. So we tried, of course, the other favorite HEC293 cells, no glutamate-gated current. And so we figured it must be something trivial, something like codon usage, lipid environment, that the worms were sufficiently different that these things just aren't going to work very well in a different membrane composition or a different temperature. And so we thought, let's just reconstitute in a more favorable environment. So we went back to the worm, and we tried reconstituting everything in the muscle cells of the worm. Now, the muscle cells have no glutamatergic neurotransmission at all. They're cholinergic, just like in our bodies. Okay? So there's no glutamate receptor components, no vesicular transporters, no glutamate, perfect naive system. So it's a bit trickier to use in a Xenopus oocyte, but it's easier than our original system because it's a naive cell, and there's lots of them. So if you mess up one, you know, patch here, you can go for the next muscle cell, and so you can get a lot more hits. So we did all that. We put all these components individually, pairwise, triplewise, made tons of transgenic strains, and none of them worked. Back to depression. So we were aware that there might be another component that was important, and that component was stargazing. So stargazing came out of genetics, actually mouse genetics. It's a founding member of what's now called the TARP family of transmembrane AMPA receptor regulatory proteins. And its original role was that it's an obligate chaperone. So in a stargazing mutant, if you look at cerebellar granule cells, there are no receptors on the cell surface. So we thought, well, gosh, you know, if the receptors never make it to the surface, that's going to explain all our negative results. More recently, there's a role for it in receptor localization. And just in the last year, a number of groups have found that it modifies receptor function as well. But the word on the street was that there are no TARPs in invertebrates. That is, it is a vertebrate specialization. And, of course, when we looked using our crude blast searches, we also didn't find anything that looked like a TARP. But we were desperate, and we, as John Isaac points out, we're good at bottom feeding. And so we looked at, you know, page 30 of the blast printout. And there you could find at very low probability things that looked remotely similar. So we found the gene that encoded something that had this kind of predictive structure, which is the structure of a stargazing protein. And, you know, I'm not going to argue that it looks like a TARP. So this is the TARP family. Actually, gamma-7 may now be in this family. But anyway, this is the TARP family. Here's C. elegans STG1. It looks just as much like stargazing as calcium channel GABA subunits or claudins. But we were desperate, and we looked in the worm to see where it was expressed, and we saw it was expressed in the same neurons that express glutamate receptors, here in the head and in the tail. And it's not expressed in the muscle, so maybe this is the missing component. And so when we looked in the muscle, here's a transgenic worm now where we express GLUR1, GLUR2, and SOL1, no current. GLIR 1 and GLIR 2 and Stargazing 1, no current, but all four together, a nice big current. Okay? And in fact, the minimal set is just to have GLIR 1, SOL 1, and Stargazing, and now you get very robust, nice glutamate-gated currents in transgenic muscles. And in fact, if you take these same three proteins and express them in Xenopus oocytes, you also get beautiful currents. Okay? So this works no matter where you express them now. So now we can return to what is SOL1 doing? Is it some kind of role in gating or desensitization? And typically, if you want to study things like gating or desensitization, you have to have a system where you can very rapidly apply agonists so that the agonist application is a step function. Okay, so you don't confound the slow kinetics of slowly dribbling on drugs, for example, with the kinetics of the receptors themselves. You want to have a step function of drug, and then you can look at what the kinetics of the receptors are. And so what most people do is they use some kind of technique like this, where you have a double-barreled electrode with buffer or agonist with a piezo drive, and you can very rapidly, within a millisecond or less, change the drug concentration. You can't do that in vivo. That's the big problem. So you have to, because in vivo, you have all these kind of flow problems. The muscle cells are inside the submarine of the worm, and you can't have quick solution change. And so what we did is we made a whole mess of different transgenic strains and then enzymatically dissociated those worms when they were eggs and cultured the muscle cells from the transgenic worms. And so now we could study the cultured cells. Okay? And so this technique was first developed a few years ago by Kevin Strange. And so you can just take cells, grow them in culture. If you express GFP in them, you can immediately figure out which are the relevant transgenic cells that you want to study. And so using that, we can now use this kind of fast perfusion system. And so the take-home message is that SOL1 seems to modulate desensitization. So here's a muscle cell that expresses GLIR1, Stargazing, and SOL1. If you apply glutamate very quickly, you see this very rapid onset of an inward current that then desensitizes partly and then stays at kind of a plateau level and then deactivates after the drug is removed. But if you wait 300 milliseconds, you see that the current hasn't fully recovered. You only get about 50% recovery, but you see the same general pattern. So this is a scaled version of that. Within about a second and a half, you have almost full recovery. Okay? So that's the three components together. So the question is, what is SOL1 doing? So we can now make a transgenic worm that expresses only GLIR1 and Stargazing, for example. And when we do that, we see a very dramatic change in the receptor properties. So the receptor is still open. So you see nice big currents, but they almost immediately collapse into a desensitized state. And that desensitization is complete. Okay, so it's gone. And then it's off. So if you think of what's important to the cell, which is the amount of charge that's transferred by the receptor, you see that the area under this curve is a very, very small fraction of the area under this curve. Moreover, it takes a long time for this channel to recover from desensitization. So by 300 milliseconds, there's almost no recovery whatsoever. And after a second and a half, you only get about 50% recovery. So I've shown you that the GLIR1 receptor, you can't really think of independently of SOL1 and Stargazing. It looks like SOL1 has a key role in modifying the rate of desensitization of the receptor. What's Stargazing do? I mean, we had to go through Stargazing to figure out SOL1. Now we're left with another puzzle. What's Stargazing do? And we can't get reconstitution without Stargazing. If we look at dissociated cells, muscle cells that express GLIR1, SOL1, and Stargazing, and you stain under non-permeabilized conditions against GLIR1, which is tagged with an HA epitope, you can see that the receptor is beautifully here at the cell surface. Now, remember, I told you that Stargazing is thought to be an obligate chaperone, but, so that's the current that we get from these cells. Stargazing is thought to be an obligate chaperone, but if we leave out Stargazing, we still see the exact same normal cell surface distribution of the GLIR1 receptor subunit. But we see no current, or very, very little current. So there might be something there. So what's Stargazing doing? It's obviously incredibly important to get current. So I've shown you it's important in reconstitution experiments. I haven't really used the power of genetics here, right? This was fishing for something that had about 20% amino acid identity and showing that it was fine for reconstitution. But it doesn't actually matter to the worm. So to study that, we knocked in the transposable element and knocked out the stargazin 1 locus. So in red here is what's been deleted, and you can see almost the entire coding region has been deleted. So is the worm alive? Yes. Does it have any behavioral phenotype? No. Unexpected. So here's this thing that's absolutely required for glutamate receptor function. We knock it out, and we look at this nose touch behavior, wild-type control, GLUR1 mutant, and stargazin-1 mutant. Doesn't look like there's anything wrong with it at all. If we look at the current from AVA, and we look at the glutamate-gated current, we see that in wild-type or stargazin-1 knockout, we see roughly the same current. That was also a huge surprise. So we thought, okay, that's fine. There probably are other stargazin-like molecules there. But so we took a candidate gene approach. We looked for anything that looked like a gamma subunit or claudin and expressed that in our reconstitution system, and nothing worked. So we found nothing by that kind of approach. We have candidates from our Lurcher suppressor screen. In the wild-type background, we found nothing that looked like a stargazin-like candidate. So we thought, well, let's take advantage of the worm genetics. And let's start with a Lurcher worm that also has a stargazin-1 mutant in the background. Okay? So it's got the lurching, it's got stargazin-1, which doesn't suppress it. And then look for a synthetic interaction. So a synthetic screen means you need a knockout of stargazin-1. We start with that. And then you look for some other random gene that's knocked out so that stargazin-1 plus the random gene together give you the phenotype. Okay? And when we did that, we identified another gene, and we call that stargazin-2. So what's stargazin-2? Well, it kind of also looks like a stargazin, same predicted identity. Here, the big surprise was that stargazin-2 is equidistant in terms of percent identity from stargazin-1 as it is from a claudin or any of these other stargazins. Okay, so it's not like some closely conserved protein. Does it do anything? Well, if we take it and look in Xenopus reconstitution experiments and you have GLUR1 and SOL1, we see no current. But if we add stargazin-1 to that mixture, we see now a nice current. Stargazin-2 gives us even a nicer, bigger current. And the two together don't seem that much different than stargazin-2, which seems to be dominant. Anyway, the take-home message is that both stargazin-1 and stargazin-2 are sufficient to reconstitute current. And they both have conserved function. So if I take a vertebrate GLUR1 and I express it at low levels in Xenopus oocytes, I see no current. If I add vertebrate stargazin, I see a nice big current. If I add the C. elegans STG1, I see a nice big current. Or if I add STG2, I see a current. So stargazin-1 and stargazin-2, widely divergent, very little conserved identity, but they work functionally for glutamate receptors, whether vertebrate or C. elegans. So where are stargazin-1 and stargazin-2? Well, they're somewhat differentially expressed. They're both found in many of the neurons that express glutamate receptors. Here's stargazin-1. You can see I have a marker here in GFP that labels AVA, and then I look with stargazin-1, and you see that there's very little overlap. So that's AVA, and there's very little red signal, suggesting that stargazin-1, in fact, is not expressed in AVA. On the other hand, if you look at that neuron AVA, again, and you look at stargazin-2 promoter-driving mCherry, you see that there's beautiful overlap. So there's differential expression of these two stargazins in the nervous system of C. elegans. Now, I want to remind you that these inner neurons and their synapses are processing modules. They process information, tactile information, osmotic information, and then generate some kind of output, which is forward or backward movement. So what kind of phenotypes do we see? Well, if we look at osmotic avoidance, there is the wild-type delay. Okay, so very quickly, they react to an osmotic stimulus and back away from it. A GLUR1 mutant is much worse at that. So it's like that. A stargaze in one mutant, in fact, looks just like wild type. And a stargaze in two mutant looks like wild type as well. So either one of these alone has no effect. But if you look in a double mutant, you see that a stargaze in one, stargaze in two, double knockout looks just like a GLUR1 knockout. And for this behavior, if you put back either stargaze in one or stargaze in two, you rescue the behavior. So it shows really that this is a very synthetic phenotype. You need both. On the other hand, if you look at another behavior, this nose touch behavior that's mediated by the same circuit, you see now that there's a differential effect. Wild type worms are very good at avoiding nose touch. GLUR1 are very bad. Stargaze in one, there's no effect. But stargaze in two, you get about 50-60% response. So it's about half as good as wild type worms. And the double mutant is just like the null for GLUR1. So the two mutants have a differential response on different behaviors mediated by the same circuit. Now, it's not because there's any kind of defect in cell surface expression. So this just shows under non-permeabilized condition, the surface expression of HA tag GLUR1. So this is an anti-HA antibody, and it's also tagged with GFP. So this shows the surface expression for wild type, for stargaze in one mutant, for stargaze in two mutant, and for the stargaze in one, stargaze in two double mutant. So for all of these, basically surface expression is ballpark the same. What happens when you look at electrophysiology? This is now recording from the interneuron AVA, nice big glutamate-gated current. If you look in the stargaze in one, stargaze in two double mutant, all the current's gone, except for the NMDA component. If you put back in stargaze in one, so you use the stargaze in one promoter to drive stargaze in one, you see that, in fact, you don't rescue. There may be a little bit of current there, but essentially there's very little rescue. But if you use the stargaze in two promoter to drive stargaze in two, you see you get about full rescue. So that shows that stargaze in two is the principal stargaze in working in the neuron AVA. Stargaze in one has very little role. Now, we can do the flip experiment. We can take this double mutant and use the stargaze in two promoter to drive stargaze in one. That doesn't work nearly as well, but it does do some rescue. But this shows that the promoters are pretty tight if you take the stargaze in one promoter and drive stargaze in two, which we know works extremely well, you get no current. So this really nails the fact that the stargazins are differentially expressed, and they have a differential effect on current magnitude. So what is it that they're doing? Our idea is that the stargazins tune current kinetics. So this is, again, the reconstitution experiment in muscle cells, GLUR1, SAW1, and stargazin. You see a rapid current that decays to a plateau level, like I showed you earlier. Now, if I do the same thing, but I use stargazin 2 instead of stargazin 1, you see that the current looks very, very different, right? It's very rapidly desensitizing, and you don't see this plateau component anymore. So the idea is that different current kinetics, different desensitization rates are going to tune cells to respond to different kind of information and process that information. So what I've shown you today is we know that stargazins were important in mammals. They're also very important in nematodes, and we've shown that at least in two different behaviors, they have a differential effect, so that stargazins are tuned for particular cells, and they do different things in those particular cells. We've also found stargazins in insects. SAW1, we found first in nematodes. We've now found them in insects. They have a conserved role. We haven't yet found them in mammals, but we can talk about that in a bit. So this idea that stargazins are important for function, we looked in yet another system, which is in Drosophila. And in Drosophila, many years ago, in 1992, Heinrich Betz published the GLUR1A receptor. And he called it a canate selective subunit that's expressed in the brain of the fly. But it's been left alone for 15 years because it's considered an orphan receptor. It doesn't respond to glutamate whatsoever. That's why they call a canate selective receptor subunit. And it binds to, it responds to kainate, like 10 millimolar kainate with like 10 nanoamp currents. Dinky little, almost insignificant currents. And we thought what must be missing is a stargazin. And so we tried, so here's Drosophila glur1a. When you put on glutamate, no current. If you add C. elegans stargazin, no current. If you add vertebrate stargazin, no current. We couldn't find the Drosophila stargazin at that point, but we found something from the Honeybee Genome Project that looked like a stargazin, only about 22% identity. And when we co-express that with Drosophila glur1a, we see this huge whopping current, okay? So if you think orphan receptor, most people think they don't know the ligand, and an orphan receptor might be because the axillary subunit isn't there. And when we looked at surface expression in Xenopus, we found no difference in surface expression whether or not you have the Apis stargazin here. In fact, there's almost a little bit less. So I'm going to just close with one last thought, which is, how did we ever discover glutamate receptors in the first place? Because they were cloned by functional expression in Xenopus oocyte, first by Michael Holman in 1989. And there's kind of two ways to think about this whole idea of working with Xenopus oocytes. The majority of people kind of think of them as, well, glorified black lipid membranes. They're naive. They're perfect. They just have a protein-making machinery, and that takes whatever gene you want and puts it in the membrane, and it works. The other way of thinking about Xenopus oocytes is, in fact, they're the kitchen sink. Every gene in the Xenopus genome, every gene product is probably in the egg itself, okay? That would be the other hypothesis. So you never know, actually, what you're studying because there's 25,000 different genes in that soup. So, you know, why do these receptors ever make it to the surface? How do they work? You can't study vertebrate glutamate receptors very well if you say that the receptor is completely dependent on stargazing to get to the surface and it doesn't work. You don't know if it's because it didn't get to the surface or because it didn't work for some other reason. So we decided to test these hypotheses and express the vertebrate glutamate receptor in C. elegans muscle. And so we now make a transgenic worm expressing a vertebrate glutamate receptor in the muscle. We spritz on glutamate, and we don't see any current. So unlike in Xenopus oocyte, where you would see a nice big current. If we add the C. elegans stargazin, we see now that we could get some current there. It's nice. If we add the vertebrate stargazin, we get a much bigger current and kind of these weird kinetics, which you don't normally see in Xenopus oocytes. But the point here is that the stargazin gives you back a lot. Only when you co-express the glutamate receptor with stargazin do you see a big current. And if you look, it's probably hard for you to see here, but if you look at the surface expression of a tag GluR1, there's no difference in the surface expression in these muscle cells of GluR1 alone or with vertebrate stargazin or C. elegans stargazin, even though the current itself is immense, immensely different. So you need stargazin to get function, even for a vertebrate glutamate receptor. So we still don't know what stargazin is doing very well, but we think it also is involved in desensitization. And the reason we think that is if you take this vertebrate glutamate receptor and put it in with stargazin, you get a nice current. Again, if you leave out the stargazin, you get almost no current. But if you make a non-desensitizing variant of GluR1, this mutation I told you about before from Sternbach and Rosenblum, the LY variant that doesn't desensitize, now you can bypass the need for stargazin. Okay? So you see a very big current, even in the absence of stargazin alone. So what I've told you today is a genetic story that's led us down a path that made it pretty clear that glutamate receptors, AMPA receptors, can no longer be thought of as standalone molecules. They have complex regulation by two axillary subunits, perhaps more, SOL1 and stargazin 1 and stargazin 2. And so it's properly can be thought of now as a glutamate receptor signaling complex. And this really brings up a whole new raft of questions. So first of all, how is this complex assembled? What gets to the receptor to the synapse first? The receptor, SOL1, stargazin, is it a complex that's packaged together? And how is this all regulated? You can imagine that there could be all kinds of mixing and matching. If stargazin 1 and stargazin 2 give such dramatic changes in desensitization rate, that's going to change how that information how a synapse processes information. So there could be dynamic regulation of these different partners. Of course, I told you earlier that drugs that target the ligand binding to GLUR1 or the pore have not found much clinical efficacy, and maybe they're too crude a tool. And it may be that with new molecular knowledge and even structure knowledge, drugs may be targeted to the interface of, let's say, SOL1 and GLUR1 or stargazins and GLUR1. Happily, for people like Mark Mayer, this is going to provide decades worth of new challenges in structure function, because if you really want to understand how the complex works, you have to understand how all these proteins come together and regulate receptor function. And finally, this is all for AMPA receptors. And as you know, there are kainate receptors and NMDA receptors. And do similar kind of auxiliary proteins exist for these receptor proteins? And my tentative notion is yes, and it's based on, again, another series of long and depressing studies where we clone NMDA receptors and express these in Xenopus oocytes. And you know what? They didn't work. And even though we have all the NMDA receptors cloned. And so our feeling is that, in fact, this is now good news. They don't work because there's probably auxiliary subunits that are missing. And by genetics, we hope to find them. So far, our notion of how to build a glutamatergic synapse has the genetic studies have found things that are important for function. And I just want to leave you with a flavor of where my lab is going to go in the future, which is we're going to try and build the Frankenworm. And the Frankenworm is a way of really rigorously testing the notion of what's important for, let's say, glutamatergic neurotransmission. So I told you that the worm neuromuscular junction works by cholinergic neurotransmission. We're knocking out all those genes, and then we're reintroducing the genes into the neuromuscular junction that we know important for glutamatergic. And so we're going to have a readout. If there's no neurotransmission there, the worm is going to be paralyzed. And we're going to try and reconstitute now, switch a cholinergic neuromuscular synapse to one that works completely on glutamatergic principles. And with that, I'll end and quickly point out the people who did all the work. Yi Zhang is a very talented graduate student who paired up with Penny Brockie, who's an associate research professor in my lab, to start the Lurcher screen and isolate SOL1. Jerry Mellum, he's done all the electrophysiology for the SOL1 paper, and he's teamed up with Mike Francis, who's now professor at UMass Worcester, to do the Stargazing 2 story and Stargazing 1 story with Craig Walker. And then Dave Mattson and someone I don't show here, Ray Wang, were instrumental in finding Stargazing 2. And with that, thank you very much. The question is, does the postsynaptic proteome show anything close to SOL1? And the answer is depends on what you call close. So no, we haven't found anything that looks like SOL1 in the proteome. The caveat there is the early proteome studies barely got even AMPA receptors. And so my feeling is that the proteome is really defined by the solubilization strategy that used to isolate the proteome itself. And so there may be many things that are missing from there. Yeah?
Can you talk about the stoichiometry? Is there a one-to-one correspondence between SOL and Stargazing and glutamate receptors? In other words, do all QR receptors have SOL and Stargazing, and are Stargazing and SOL not present with other receptors?
So the question is the stoichiometry. Do you always find Stargazings associated with glutamate receptors? So I didn't show that data. When we use GFP and mCherry tags, we see considerable overlap, but we also between stargazins and glutamate receptors. But you also see stargazins where we see no glutamate receptors. The question of stoichiometry I don't think has been addressed by any lab. So is it 1, 2, or 4 stargazins per tetrameric glutamate receptor? It's not known. That's a difficult question to address. There's some suggestions from cryo-EM work that there may be two stargazins per complex, but that's based on kind of big blobs that we don't really know about. Genetically, it seems like there is some evidence to suggest that two different stargazins may bind to the same glutamate receptor complex. So we see non-additive effects in some, under some conditions in the current when we compare stargazin 1 versus stargazin 2 versus the double. But we don't know the stoichiometry.
So kind of a functional QR complex requires all three of those molecules. How can you argue that interfering with Sol or stargazin would have a different effect as a drug than interfering with the glutamate receptor?
Well, I'm arguing it just on the basis of a different site of action. So the drugs that work now are targeted to the ligand binding pocket or to the pore itself. And so these can prevent, you know, if you have enough drug there, you get no glutamate binding or the pore itself is closed. What Sol1 does is, in fact, the receptor is still working. It's still binding glutamate. It's still transmitting ions. But the rate of desensitization is slightly tweaked, as is true for perhaps for stargazin 1 and 2. So I have no real convincing argument to tell you that this is going to be a very fruitful path for drug discovery. But drug discovery usually works on looking for a plausible target. And I would say that these are plausible targets. And they could be specific targets. So if there are different stargazins that interact with AMPA receptors and they have different contact surfaces, you can imagine now you can have very specific type of modulation, drugs that interfere with specific types of modulation. But, I mean, it's just it's a hopeful theory. Yeah, Mark.
You've sort of built a case that the modulation of the genetics of gating desensitization plays an important role in synaptic function here. But what you haven't shown us, and I don't know if it's technically possible to get this information, is what the genetics of synaptic transmission actually look like in this very simple neuronal circuit.
So Mark's asking about more detailed electrophysiology. What I've shown you is the kind of first order, very crude electrophysiology, which is puffing on glutamate. And what you really want to do is study, minis and evoked release to show how the synapse is actually working. And it is technically very hard. So we spent quite a while trying, while we patch clamp from the neuron AVA, blowing by different osmotic stimuli and trying to hit the worm in the snout. We could see evoked currents, but it was a very tricky preparation. We're switching now to a different approach that's been made possible by these channel rhodopsins. And so we've made transgenic worms that express channel rhodopsin, which is a light-activated conductance, in the sensory neuron. And when we shine on light, we see as a behavioral effect, the worm stops and goes backwards. And so we hope with this now that we can have a good way of stimulating using light the presynaptic inputs and doing exactly what you suggest, looking at what the true synaptic currents look like. Yeah?
Yeah, what's your sense of the potential function of the CUB domains?
So the question is, what do the CUB domains do? So Sol1 has four of these CUB domains, which are found in hundreds of different proteins, are thought to mediate protein-protein interaction. That's about as much as I know about them. And we think that the CUB domains is really the business end of Sol1. So we've taken the four CUB domains from Sol1 and put them onto the PDGF receptor transmembrane domain. So this, and then taken that chimeric gene, expressed it in transgenic worms, and asked, does it rescue behavior, does it rescue current? And it rescues it just fine. So the transmembrane domain has very little effect on function. We think most of the function is in the CUB domains. Moreover, we've knocked out the first two CUB domains, and we still get pretty good partial rescue. And in fact, if you notice, all our genetic mutations were in CUB domains 3 and 4. So we think those subdomains are incredibly important. Finally, we've been able to make in transgenic worms a soluble form, a secreted form, that has no transmembrane domain at all, and that also partially rescues. So we think that SOL1 is localized at the synapse, probably binds to a variety of different scaffolding proteins, including the glutamate receptor, to achieve its function. And in fact, in collaboration with Mark, we're trying to, since we have at least the idea that the notion that a soluble SOL1 is functional, we're hoping to see if we can make recombinant soluble SOL1 and see if that rescues in kind of a reconstitution experiments.
Okay, one more.
So, you showed with stargazers that one STGG1 does one thing and STGG2 does another thing. Whereas SOL1, you only identify one protein in that family that seems to be important. Is it possible there are other SOL genes around, or SOL-like proteins around? So if you looked at another behavior, that SOL1 wouldn't be involved in that behavior.
So the question is SOL1 unique? And so far in our genetic screens looking for AMPA receptor function, we haven't found that anything else except SOL1. Now, in the worm, we can measure NMDA currents and kainate-gated currents. So we think that those receptor families are conserved, and SOL1 is not required for any of those. There's another group, Jean-Louis Bessereau's group in Paris, that looked at acetylcholine function, neuromuscular junction function, and they found a protein called LEV10. It has a number of domains, but it includes three or four subdomains. It looks kind of like our SOL1 protein. So the simple answer is yes. I think that there probably are other SOL1 type proteins, and they probably are important for other receptors.
Okay, thanks once again.
Thank you.
Thanks.